They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax, I'm Sue Bartholomew, and joining us today we have Robert Dublierer. Did I pronounce that properly, Robert?
Yes, you did. Thank you very much.
Sometimes I get stuck on names. But anyway, welcome to On the Commons. I'm really looking forward to talking to you. Robert is an attorney and a co-op owner in New Jersey, where they've had a lot of problems, and they've gone to court a number of times, actually protecting their constitutional rights, and that's exactly what Rob did. Rob, tell us, you've had a long journey. I mean, it's what, 6-7 years almost?
I filed suit in this case against the co-op in March of 2008, so that's nearly 7 years ago.
Wow, it's been a long time.
Yes, it has.
So why did you do it? Tell us your story. I know that it started right from the beginning, and for those, because co-ops seem to be mostly in New Jersey, New York, Chicago, very few co-ops outside of those areas. So a lot of people don't fully understand what a co-op really is. But a co-op, they can actually, the board interviews you before you're allowed to move in.
Yes. As compared to a condominium, in a co-op, a person buys shares in the co-op corporation, as opposed to, in a condominium, actually buying the real estate itself.
So you actually went through the interview process before you were allowed to move in?
Correct.
What happened? Tell us.
Well, briefly stated, I'm handicapped due to multiple sclerosis, and at the time I walked on crutches. I made it known to the board that parking was important to me, and that I would require a handicapped parking space. I was told that there were a limited number of spots and that I would be placed on a waiting list, but that should not be a problem because there was what they called valet parking available, and so I was satisfied, and my wife and I bought the shares and moved into the apartment. That was July of 2002.
And they couldn't have just taken a regular spot and made it handicapped?
Well, what they said was, and it turned out not to be quite true, that the space went along with the apartment, so that unless there was a particular need to change it, the board said it could not or would not move someone out of an already assigned space. So it was a question of waiting for a space, a suitable space, to become available.
And there was nothing that could have been suitable and turned into, I mean, because it's just a matter of painting the, you know, assigning it as handicapped spaces, right?
Yes, but as I say, the board's position was it would not take a space away from someone who already had it, claiming that it went with the apartment. Legally, that was not correct. Okay, the board possessed the power. They simply chose not to use it.
So you waited?
I did. I waited for about 9 or 10 months, and each time I went to the office, I was told that I was still on the waiting list, but there was nothing suitable available. At that time, I thought my problem was with the office staff, and particularly the property manager. And so my wife and I decided to appeal to the president of the board to make sure he knew about the situation and ask for his help in resolving it. So my wife and I discussed the matter, and she said that she wanted to write the letter because, as she put it, it would be a nicer letter than if I wrote it. And she was correct. She was a social worker by education and training and profession, and she was much better at making peace than I was. So she wrote a letter to the president of the board, seeking his assistance in getting me a handicapped parking space, and put the note under his apartment door.
And that was a no-no.
As it turned out, it was. We had lived in a condominium immediately prior to coming to this place, and notes under the door were an acceptable form of communication. And there was nothing that I had seen that indicated that this was not acceptable here. But instead, my wife received, since the letter was addressed to her, about 2 weeks later, she received a letter for the lawyer for the co-op, indicating that in placing the letter under the president's apartment door, she had violated a house rule. This also turned out not to be true, but that was the claim, that in violating the house rule, we had violated the underlying proprietary lease, and that as a result, the co-op could be required, or was required, to notify our mortgage lender, and the violation of our proprietary lease could result in our mortgage lender immediately calling in the mortgage loan. The letter went on to say essentially that they would not notify the mortgage lender, but there should be no further problems from us, from my wife. And on the merits, the letter said that the board would not help us to get the handicapped parking space.
Oh, so at that time they told you no handicap parking space because you violated their sacred rule.
Actually, they told us that since the letter had sought the board's assistance or the president's assistance in getting a handicap parking space, it was not so much that it would never happen, but rather that they would take no action to speed up the process or to help me out. Also, the claim of valet parking turned out not to be true because what the building called valet parking was actually delivering the car to the lower garage where an attendant would take it and then getting oneself from the lower garage back to the building lobby, which required a walk of some distance or climbing stairs.
So what about the Americans with Disabilities Act, fair housing? It sounds like they're violating all of those laws.
Well, what I did was to file a complaint with HUD, which administers the ADA with regard to housing, claiming a violation because of the co-op's failure to make a suitable, reasonable accommodation to my handicap. That HUD proceeding took 3 years, but ultimately I won, and the building was forced to give me a handicap parking space and $10,000, and they did.
So for 3 years, you had to go through the rigmarole of parking in the basement and then getting yourself up to your unit.
Yes, they also gave us an outside space some distance from the front door, which required you know, walking on the crutches for some distance. And until we won the HUD, that's what I did.
Rob, that sounds absolutely cruel.
It was. And I must say, as a result of the outcome, the president no longer disliked me, but he considered me an enemy to be roundly defeated and used as an example to anyone else who might want to cross him.
You said that they told you they could notify your mortgage company, your lender.
Correct.
That you
Correct.
Had violated a rule. I mean, this, the fact that you slipped a letter under the president's door is just such a heinous crime.
Well, I must say that I was not the only one, or my wife was not the only one to receive such a letter. It was sent to many different people for many alleged infractions, and essentially was used to intimidate the owners and to keep them in line. In this way, the president remained president for more than 25 years. Most of the time, he ran unopposed.
Is it true? I mean, you're an attorney. Is it true that the mortgage company is going to get involved in a local association dispute like that?
As a practical matter, I think it's unlikely, but most people don't take it that far and will simply knuckle under. Also, as I say, the claim that in placing a single letter under the president's door, she had violated a house rule was actually false. The house rule in question prohibits, without the board's authorization, the distribution of written material anywhere in the building. So they equated, or the lawyer equated, the placing of a single letter under one apartment door to the distribution of written material, which is what the house rule actually prohibits.
Well, they call it, what is it they called it? Littering? No, paper pollution.
That was the claim that the rule was meant to protect.
Which is absolutely insane. Yeah, I read the lawsuit this morning.
Yes.
And the goal of this rule, apparently, was to preserve the residents' quiet enjoyment of their units and to cut down on paper pollution.
That was the reason given for the rule.
How wonderful. Dumb, keep them dumb and
intimidated.
Intimidated and divided. Because if you talk to people, you can unite, right?
That's a side issue. Yes, that's certainly a side concern.
So you decided to run for the board.
I did. I thought nothing is going to change with the board in its then current makeup, since basically all of the board, as well as the general populace, was under the thumb of the board president, and that the property manager was simply carrying out his wishes. So I did plan to run for the board, and in connection with that plan, I wrote a letter to the board asking them if the rule against distributing written material anywhere in the building applied to campaign materials, since I was planning on running for the board. In response, I received a letter from the same lawyer for the building saying that the rule is clear and applies to everything. And so I responded that in another letter to the board, that since the rule prohibited distributing written material without authorization of the board, I asked permission from the board to distribute campaign materials if I did run for the board.
How galling to have to go and get permission to campaign.
Yes, but that in and of itself is not illegal. So it was necessary to ask for authorization, and that authorization was refused.
So, and on what grounds?
Well, there were no grounds, and as it turned out, the board never really discussed the question. It was, my letter was simply referred to the lawyer for automatic rejection. The board was notified that I had sent the letter and what it said, but the letter itself was never discussed by the board. It was simply rejected automatically by the attorney.
You know, you keep getting these letters from the attorney for the associate, for the co-op.
Yes.
Did they charge you for those letters? Because quite often that's what they'll do, and they'll build up. You know,
no.
These things. So the co-op actually paid for the attorney fees.
Yes. I think he certainly never said it this way, but I came to learn that the president was willing to spend as much of the co-op's money as necessary to enforce his will on the co-op.
Is he still president?
He passed away about 2.5 years ago.
And have things
but he died as president. And I'm convinced that if he were still alive, he would still be president.
Really? He had that strong a hold on the place, huh?
Yes. As I say, he had been president for more than 25 years and usually ran unopposed.
You know, people shouldn't, there ought to be term limits in these things. People shouldn't be on the board for ever and ever.
I agree. I think that without term limits, there can certainly be excesses since power tends to corrupt. But, you know, there can be benevolent leaders also. He was not.
Was he popular among your neighbors? Or
I would say he certainly had his supporters. There were many people who didn't care, since they did not annoy him or cross him. And so the building ran smoothly. I must say one of the reasons my wife and I wanted to live here is it is very well kept and always has been.
Is it an older?
Had I known what was in store, we would not have moved here, but we didn't know.
Yeah, so you do regret having moved in?
I regret that it was necessary for me to do what I ultimately did. I would have preferred to live peacefully somewhere else, but now that it's over, I'm glad that we're here. Actually, my wife has passed away. I'm glad I'm here. And I'm glad I did what I did, and I'm glad I stuck to it, even though it took a long time. The HUD suit took 3 years, and this lawsuit took more than 6, nearly 7.
We're talking to Rob Dublerer, and Rob has found out firsthand what it's like to live in a controlled environment. And in his case, it was a little more controlled and a little less reasonable than even some of the other associations out there where you hear a lot of these horror stories. So you got your parking space, Rob, and
correct.
You then ended up filing a lawsuit.
Right.
In
connection with my plan to run for a position on the board of directors, when I was denied permission to distribute campaign material, which would have described my qualifications, experience, and my vision for the building, the things I liked and agreed with, and as well as the things that I disagreed with, and what changes I would seek to make. I thought that without the ability to do that, there was no point in running. And so I sued the board and the president. Actually, I sued the co-op corporation, and in that way wound up, along with all of the other owners, paying for the co-op's legal fees against me.
And you had to pay for it.
Well, again,
as an owner,
I, along with all the other owners, paid the fees. which funded the lawsuit, which funded the building's defense of my lawsuit. Of course, had the building said that it would allow this kind of distribution of campaign materials, then there would have been no lawsuit and no need to fund a defense. But as I say, the president was willing to spend as much of the co-op's money as necessary to win his point and discourage those who would cross him. In fact, as a countersuit, the co-op corporation sued me to pay all of its legal bills myself, so that very early on they wanted me to come up with more than $25,000 that the building spent on its defense. Ultimately, I believe the building's legal fees totaled more than $100,000.
In New Jersey, are you entitled to fees if you win your case?
No, the New Jersey rule, which is also called the American rule, generally supports the payment of legal fees by each side. Each side pays its own. There are exceptions, and the building made its counterclaim based on a paragraph in the proprietary lease, but they lost on that countersuit in trying to make me liable for its legal fees.
And you were a pro se litigant, right?
That's correct. I'm a lawyer admitted to practice in New York. I was admitted in 1975, so I've been a practicing lawyer in New York for almost 40 years.
And so you knew your way around the courtroom, and you knew the law, and you knew all about the First Amendment, which is what your case was all about, right?
Well, yes, in the sense that when a person says First Amendment, they're frequently talking about freedom of speech. Technically, the First Amendment would not apply in my case because the federal government, in interpreting the Constitution, and most states, for that matter, in interpreting their own state constitution, require government action, or what's called state action, to apply. And because the rule prohibiting distribution of written materials in the building was not issued or enforced by the government, but rather by a private co-op corporation, the First Amendment literally did not apply, and I would have lost on constitutional grounds in a federal court and in most state courts. The reason I was able to sue on constitutional grounds in New Jersey is because New Jersey courts have indicated or have held that the constitutional right to free speech is not limited to governmental action and may apply to private interests under certain limited circumstances. I was only interested in bringing this lawsuit on constitutional grounds because I thought it was a matter of constitutional importance. There are other grounds on which the lawsuit could have been based and been successful in New York and other states, but bringing it on constitutional grounds was really limited to something that could be done successfully only in New Jersey and a few other states.
So the Supreme Court in New Jersey has dealt with pretty much associations and or private property and the individual's right to campaign, to free speech. Twin Rivers, they had the signs up.
Right.
Mazda Brook, you had the signs that were up as well. There was, and I can't remember the case now, where people were not allowed to campaign in the building that was adjacent to the mall?
Well, the earlier cases in New Jersey dealt with private property owners such as a university. There was a case involving Princeton University,
right.
Or a large regional mall, private property ownership, and people wanting to come onto that private property and talk about political issues of the day. And in those, based on those cases, the Supreme Court of New Jersey held that a freedom of speech issue of constitutional proportions exists in New Jersey and developed a scheme to determine whether those rights were violated in the individual cases. What my case ultimately did was to have the court held in my case earlier this month on December 3rd, that when you're looking at private property where people live, and more than that, private property wherein the person wanting to speak is an owner, as in a co-op, condominium, or homeowners association, that different test, a different test applies. And that's what made this case new and different in New Jersey.
So, yeah, they keep building on it, and it seems like every case sort of adds a little bit.
Right, and in future cases, the court will decide, based on the facts in those cases, that whether the rule applies, and if so, whether the rule has been whether the constitutional issue of freedom of speech applies, and if so, whether it has been violated. Because in Committee for a Better Twin Rivers, for example, the Supreme Court of New Jersey held that the constitutional right of freedom of speech applied, but was not violated based on the limited restrictions that the co-op rules placed on individuals, and the alternative methods of getting the word out that was available to owners and residents. So in that case, as I say, the court held that the constitutional right applied but was not violated. In my case and in Mazdabrook, the court held that the right applied and was violated, although for somewhat different reasons based on different facts.
So you went through, you lost the first round.
Right. In the trial court, I lost on the merits, at least as to that. On the counterclaim, that is, the co-ops seeking to make me liable, have me held liable for its legal fees, I won on that issue in each court. But on the merits of the constitutional issue, the trial judge held that there had been no violation of a constitutional right based on these facts. The appellate division unanimously reversed on that issue, and the Supreme Court unanimously affirmed the order of the appellate division, although its analysis was a little different.
So ultimately you won, but you had to go through all three courts.
Correct,
basically,
and that's certainly in large part why it took so long.
When you live in something like a co-op with all of these other people, and I don't know how many units and how many residents there are there, but isn't part of the idea of having these so-called communities that people would be able to interact and become part of a community?
I guess that depends on whom you ask. the president would not have agreed with that. The idea, at least as the board presented it, was that people should be able to live in peace and harmony at least as far as the board was concerned, peace and harmony meant doing what the board said, and not crossing the board.
And it was it's a 7-member board, right? How did the other 6 members feel? Were they also entrenched board members, or were they able to run for the board and get elected for a term or two?
No one who was not supported by the president ever ran successfully for the board.
Oh. So the
if someone were elected to the board on the president's recommendation and subsequently crossed the president, then another candidate would be supported by the president, and no independent or insurgent candidate was ever elected to the board until after his death.
So the decision just came down. You just won a few days ago. So this
Correct.
Is brand new.
Correct.
Are you going to run for the board, or are you happy with the way things are now?
Well, truthfully, since the president's death, and in the things have gotten much better. In the election following his death, 6 new board members were elected. There is only one holdover from the old board, and he was not particularly objectionable. The president, of course, is deceased, and other objectionable members of the board were voted off. 2 of them ran for re-election in this past election, and at least in part because of my statements against them, they were defeated. And the new board, I have not had any trouble with at all. They have been very decent to me.
So you have your space, and you can come and go easily, and you're not being hounded and harassed right now. You also had a newsletter, the MedSouth Gadfly?
Correct. The House rule, remember, prohibited distribution of written materials anywhere on the premises. In our case, the building held 2 board meetings a year off-site because there's no place on-site large enough to have the meeting. The board could not prohibit the distribution of written material off-site, although I expect they would have loved to if they could. And so I created a publication called the MedSouth Gadfly, wherein I wrote articles about some of the things that the board was doing or that the president was doing so that people would know, because the board distributed memos of its own inside the building. In other words, the board gave permission to itself to do that, and those memos were always self-congratulatory, trumpeting the board's accomplishments, and actually very harassing and trying to intimidate those who disagreed and questioning our motives, our intelligence, and our sanity.
And they put all this in writing?
Oh, yes.
And they
many personal attacks in those memos and at meetings. And the irony is that they did this in memos which were distributed under every owner's door, but I could not respond even to say I disagree or what my side of the argument was. And yet the trial court found in favor of the board in terms of my constitutional right to free speech.
And if you ran for the board, you were allowed to go knocking on doors trying to get proxies, but you were not allowed to discuss the issues. I find that incredible.
right. The board's interpretation was that it was important that the election be valid, and by that I mean that it not fail for want of a quorum. So it was permissible for anyone to go door-to-door to obtain ballot proxies. But they did not permit electioneering so that I could go around to collect proxies, but I was not permitted to say anything, even if I were on the ballot, as to why anyone should vote for me.
But why... How can they stop you from doing that? That just absolutely blows my mind. You can knock on doors. You can ask for people's proxy. If you wanted my proxy, I'd want to know what you were going to do with that and why.
And under the rule, I would not be allowed to tell you.
And that's absurd. That's a thing. Did that come up in court?
Yes.
Yes.
And that was a point was made of that by the trial court. But that judge nevertheless held that no constitutional right was violated.
I mean, I would have been absolutely appalled. But yet, the police, the ambulance corps, the firefighters were all allowed to come in and knock on doors to collect money at Christmas time.
Christmas time, correct. They were also allowed to put... things under the doors for the purpose of fundraising.
What about paper pollution?
Yes. Now, well, as I one of the things that came up during the argument of this case that I had to make clear several different times, I was not campaigning to force others to stop distributing their message, such as the police, fire department, or ambulance corps. I was not looking to have the house rule determined so that no one could distribute. I was simply saying that if you allow all of these different parties to distribute written materials, how can you deny me the right to do the same thing, particularly when I'm running for a place on the board and trying to distinguish myself from all of you?
What did your neighbors say? I mean, I know there's a lot of fear out there, and I know that they allow themselves to be intimidated, and very few people will stand up and say, wait a minute, you don't decide who I talk to. I think that would be my reaction. But Have things changed? Has there been a sort of more of a relaxed atmosphere since the lawsuit?
I would say not since the lawsuit, but since the president's death. Nothing would be different until the conclusion of the lawsuit were the president still alive.
So you think he'd still be ruling with an iron fist?
As long as he could. And the lawsuit finally would have stopped that. As it happened, his death stopped that, and as I say, the new board has been fine. I've had no problems with them, which is not to say that I agree with the new board about everything, but rather that the new board is not afraid of different opinions.
Is there more of trying to find out what everybody thinks or wants? Is there more of a let's reach out and see what people want? Let's foster a sense of community.
I think rather so than reaching out so much, the new board accepts suggestions and requests of different kinds. It is not closed to those with other opinions. I would not say that so much that they reach out to get them, but that they are open to them when they are given.
Is it still the same management company, still the same manager?
It is the same property manager. It is not an independent company. The property manager is a building employee.
Oh, so it's
and I must say that the property manager, who has been property manager for about 20 years, I believe since 1992, so more than 20 years, had been personally selected by the former president. They had worked together prior to her coming here in a separate business. So she came and basically implemented his policies.
And is she, and so has she relaxed a little bit, or things still the same?
I would say when she hasn't, she has been properly rebuked by the board.
So finally the board is actually doing something.
Oh, as I think, as I said, when people have an unpleasant run-in with the property manager, they are free to go to members of the board and voice their complaints, and if the board thinks it is appropriate, they correct the property manager's behavior.
You told me the other day when we were talking, you told me that now that you've won your lawsuit, all of a sudden you've got other people that are going around and distributing flyers, leaflets, whatever. They want to make it a pet-friendly building?
Well, I'm not sure who was behind it, but shortly after the decision in my case, I received a writing under the door, which was really I'd say questionnaire, but it was a single question. Do you want to see pets allowed in the building? The current rule is no pets. And so I responded to that question. But that's not really what the case was about.
No.
But, you know, it's probably allowable now.
Well, it should be because you know, it's the residents, the owners, who should be making the decisions.
Well, it's certainly the residents who should be discussing the issues and expressing their views and ultimately deciding how to, you know, what policy to make or to change. So, yes, to that extent, I agree with that.
You had a couple of amicus curiae that were filed on your behalf. One of them was from CAI, the Community Associations Institute, probably not wanting you to win, absolutely not. You gave up that right, and you don't have to, the association, the co-op, doesn't have to allow you to converse or interact with your neighbors. That's absolutely terrible. It would be the end of civilization as we know it.
Well, I guess the answer is yes and no. And by that I mean this. The American Civil Liberties Union, New Jersey chapter,
right,
came in as an amicus on my side.
Yes.
And saying that it was a violation of my New Jersey state constitutional right to free speech. CAI attempted to come in as an amicus, but I opposed them because although they are an organization whose opinions and statement of the law would be worthwhile, they were very late in filing their application to be an amicus, and ultimately the court decided that because of the lateness of their application, they were not their application to become an amicus was denied. It's standard when you make an application to become an amicus that you submit a brief not only in support of your application, but the brief that you would submit to the court on the main issues if your application is granted. And so the CAI did submit a brief, but as I say, their application was denied, and therefore their brief was not considered.
So, well, that's good to know because, and I'm surprised because they're usually right out there, right up front with all of these things.
Yes, apparently someone was asleep at the switch and did not recognize when the appellate division opinion came out because they were very late in making their they were months late in making their application.
And well, that's good to know. But Frank Askin, my old friend Frank Askin, who's been on the show a number of times, and his constitutional law clinic.
Yes, they came in as amicus on my side, and Mr. Askin argued on my side, presenting the views of the ACLU at oral argument in September.
So the ACLU is all about First Amendment. Yes, and so they'll come in with the free speech. Rob, we've got people listening who are going through a whole lot of the things that you've been through. Do you have any words of wisdom to share with them? People are being denied their right to speak, to run, to communicate, to interact with their neighbors.
Well, I would say a couple of things. First, every person needs to decide for him or herself whether the fight is worth it, because it does take time, it does take effort, and usually it also takes money. Most people are not able to do it on their own. They need to hire attorneys. That was one thing I didn't have to do, so that was that certainly made it easier for me. Another is that on the merits, as I say, in most states, in the United States, they would lose on the constitutional issue, so don't limit yourself to constitutional issues. There are other standards for determining the reasonableness of homeowner association or co-op or condo board rules and regulations. And so you should check within your state or even within your community what the rules are, what the laws are, and on what basis then the rules of the association can be challenged. As I say, in New Jersey, I could have challenged on other grounds and won, but I chose not to do that. I chose to make it strictly a matter of constitutional importance, knowing that in New Jersey, the courts will, in certain cases, allow challenges in private ownership situations as opposed to state action.
What, for instance, what other arguments could you have made? Because I've heard that a lot of courts don't even like to reach the constitutional question. A lot of lower courts just want to distance themselves totally and
right.
want to rule on the least item. But you put all your eggs in that one constitutional basket, right?
Correct. In many states, there are laws which require board of directors to act reasonably. There may be special rules regarding boards of community, residential communities, common interest residential communities, co-ops, condos, and homeowner associations requiring boards to act reasonably vis-a-vis the other owners. And there are such things in New Jersey. There are also common law requirements regarding real estate ownership vis-a-vis tenants and people living in the residential community. So those are other grounds, the common law rules as well as the statutory rules within the particular jurisdiction. So constitutional is not the only ground on which the case can be won, and that's very important because in most states, the constitutional issue is a loser for the owner because it's a private organization.
It's a private organization, and what CAI will tell you is that you agreed to this. But the thing is, nobody actually agrees to all of the stuff that happens. You didn't agree to be gagged, basically, before you moved in.
Well, the one response to a CAI interpretation is, do the rules accurately give notice to what actually is prohibited?
You know, I had someone from CAI on the show years and years ago, and I said, all right, you know, if they agreed, let's make sure that they know what they're agreeing to. Let's list the following things. And I went through a whole list of stuff. And the guy was in the studio with me, was sitting across the table from me, and he looked at me and he said, are you crazy? If people knew what they were getting into, they'd never buy in an HOA.
That's right.
And so...
That really has to do as much with the interpretation given to the rules by the homeowners association. When you have reasonable people in the homeowners association, their interpretation is reasonable, and people should be bound by that. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be rules and limitations for a homeowner in a homeowners association, but they should be reasonable. And if a rule is in existence, for example, a no pet policy, it should be clear that before a person buys into a home in that association that that's the policy, so that you can later, if necessary, come back and say, you knew when you came in that this was the rule, and by coming in and by signing, you agreed to it. The problem that the associations run into frequently is that they interpret rules in such a powerful way that and such a way to deprive homeowners of their rights, whether statutory or constitutional, that the homeowner is not really warned in advance that this is the policy. If the policy is clearly stated, then the homeowner really has very little recourse.
I think a lot of the rules and a lot of the laws are intentionally vague, and that's to give people the opportunity to interpret them any way they want. And when you look at the reasonableness standard, I mean, that's so subjective. What's reasonable to me may not be reasonable to you.
Well, I agree in that people can have different preferences and opinions about what a rule means, or want, whether they would want the rule or not, or agree to the rule or not. But if the rule itself is clear, so that the person is put on notice that this is what is required or what is prohibited, then the person makes the determination for him or herself, am I willing to agree to this? Now, I must say that by the time you get to that point, you've already looked at the place, you've agreed on a price, once, yeah, you know, usually before you actually,
yeah,
even look at the rules,
yeah,
or are shown the rules, that it's pretty late in the game to decide, no, I'm not willing to be bound by it.
Yeah.
It's so that most people sign regardless, but at least if the rule is clear, then people should be aware before they finally put their signature on the deed that this is what is going to be required or prohibited. And then their avenues of recourse are properly diminished.
Rob, thank you so very much for joining us today, for sharing your story with us, and congratulations on your great win.
Thank you very much, Sue.
Thank you to all of you for joining us.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.